I said with a smile. I have the sickness to prove it. Would you like me to tell the others? I didn't want Goody Alsop to shoulder any extra burdens, emotional or physical. Susanna was worried about her frailty, and Elizabeth Jackson was already taking on some of the duties usually performed by the gathering's elder. No need. Catherine was the one to tell me. She said Cora was flying about a few days ago, chortling and chattering as she does when she has a secret. We had come to an agreement, my fire drake and I, that she would limit her open-air flying to once a week and only at night. I'd reluctantly agreed to a second night out during the dark of the moon, when the risk of anyone seeing her and mistaking her for a fiery portent of doom was at its lowest. So that's where she went, I said with a laugh. Cora found the witch's company soothing, and Catherine enjoyed challenging her to fire-breathing contests. We are all glad that Cora has found something to do with herself besides clinging to the chimney pieces and shrieking at the ghosts. Goody Alsop pointed to the chair opposite. Will you not sit with me? The goddess may not afford us another chance. Did you hear the news from Scotland? I asked as I took my seat. I have heard nothing since you told me that pleading her belly did not save Euphemia MacLean from the pyre. Goody Alsop's decline began the night I'd told her that a young witch from Berwick had been burned, in spite of Matthew's efforts. Matthew finally convinced the rest of the congregation that the spiral of accusations and executions had to stop. Two of the accused witches have overturned their testimony and said their confessions were the result of torture. It must have given the congregation pause to have a wech speak out on behalf of a witch. Goody Alsop looked at me sharply. He would give himself away if you were to stay. Matthew Royden lives in a world of half-truths, but no one can avoid detection forever. Because of the babe, you must take greater care. We will, I assured her. Meanwhile, I'm still not absolutely sure my eighth knot is strong enough for the time-walking, not with Matthew and the baby. Let me see it, Goody Alsop said, stretching out her hand. I leaned forward and put the cords into her palm. I would use all 9 cords when we time-walked and make a total of 9 different knots. No spell used more. With practiced hands, Goody Alsop made 8 crossings in the red cord and then bound the ends together so that the knot was unbreakable. That is how I do it. It was beautifully simple. With open loops and swirls like the stone traceries in a cathedral window. Mine did not look like that. My laugh was rueful. It wiggled and squiggled around. Every weaving is as unique as the weaver who makes it. The goddess does not want us to imitate some ideal of perfection, but to be our true selves. Well, I must be all wiggle, then. I reached for the cords to study the design. There is another knot I would show you, Goody Alsop said. Another? I frowned. A 10th knot. It is impossible for me to make it, though it should be the simplest. Goody Alsop smiled, but her chin trembled. My own teacher could not make the knot either, but still we passed it on, in hope that a weaver such as you might come along. Goody Alsop released the just-tied knot with a flick of her gnarled index finger. I handed the red silk back to her, and she made a simple loop. For a moment, the cord fused in an unbroken ring. As soon as she took her fingers from it, however, the loop released. But you drew the ends together just a minute ago, and with a far more complicated weaving, I said confused. As long as there is a crossing in the cord, I can bind the ends and complete the spell. But only a weaver who stands between worlds can make the 10th knot, she replied. Try it. Use the silver silk. Mystified, I joined the ends of the cord into a circlet. The fibers snapped together to form a loop with no beginning and no ending. I lifted my fingers from the silk, but the circle held. A fine weaving, Goody Alsop said with satisfaction. The 10th knot captures the power of eternity, a weaving of life and death. It is rather like your husband's snake, or the way Cora carries her tail in her mouth sometimes when it gets in her way. She held up the 10th knot. It was another Ouroboros, the sense of the uncanny built in the room, lifting the hairs on my arm. Creation and destruction are the simplest magics, and the most powerful, just as the simplest knot is the most difficult to make.
I don't want to use magic to destroy anything, I said. The bishops had a strong tradition of not doing harm. My Aunt Sarah believed that any witch who strayed away from this fundamental tenet would find the evil coming back to her in the end.
No one wants to use the goddess's gifts as a weapon, but sometimes it is necessary. Your Werch knows that. After what happened here and in Scotland, you know it too.
Perhaps. But my world is different, I said. There's less call for magical weapons.
Worlds change, Diana.
Goody Allsup fixed her attention on some distant memory.
My teacher, Mother Ursula, was a great weaver. I was reminded of one of her prophecies on All Hallows' Eve, when the terrible events in Scotland began, and when you came to change our world.
Her voice took on the sing-song quality of an incantation.
For storms will rage and oceans roar when Gabriel stands on sea and shore, and as he blows his wondrous horn, old worlds die and new be born.
Not a breeze or a crackle of flame disturbed the room when Goody Allsup finished. She took a deep breath.
It is all one, you see. Death and birth. The tenth knot with no beginning and no ending, and the Werch's snake. The full moon that shone earlier this week, and the shadow Cora cast upon the Thames in a portent of your leaving. The old world and the new.
Goody Allsup's smile wavered.
I was glad when you came to me, Diana Royden. And when you go, as you must, my heart will be heavy.
Usually Matthew tells me when he's leaving my city.
Andrew Hubbard's white hands rested on the carved arms of his chair in the church crypt. High above us, someone prepared for an upcoming church service.
What brings you here, Mistress Royden?
I came to talk to you about Annie and Jack. Hubbard's strange eyes studied me as I pulled a small leather purse from my pocket. It contained 5 years of wages for each of them. I'm leaving London. I would like you to have this for their care.
I thrust the money in Hubbard's direction. He made no move to take it.
That isn't necessary, mistress.
Please. I would take them with me if I could. Since they cannot go, I need to know that someone will be watching out for them.
And what will you give me in return?
Why, the money, of course. I held the pouch out once more.
I don't want or need the money, Mistress Royden.
Hubbard settled back in his chair, his eyes drifting closed. What do you...
I stopped.
No.
God does nothing in vain. There are no accidents in his plans. He wanted you to come here today because he wants to be sure that no one of your blood will have anything to fear from me or mine.
I have protectors enough, I protested.
And can the same be said for your husband?
Hubbard glanced at my breast.
Your blood is stronger in his veins now than when you arrived, and there is the child to consider.
My heart stuttered. When I took my Matthew back to our present, Andrew Hubbard would be one of the few people who would know his future, and that there was a witch in it. You wouldn't use the knowledge of me against Matthew, not after what he's done, how he's changed.
Wouldn't I?
Hubbard's tight smile told me he would do whatever it took to protect his flock.
There is a great deal of bad blood between us.
I'll find another way to see them safe, I said, deciding to go.
Annie is my child already. She's a witch and part of my family. I will see to her welfare. Jack Blackfriars is another matter. He is not a creature and will have to fend for himself.
He's a child. A boy.
But not my child. Nor are you. I do not owe either of you anything. Good day, Mistress Royden.
Hubbard turned away. And if I were one of your family, what then?
Would you honor my request about Jack? Would you recognize Matthew as one of my blood and therefore under your protection?
It was the 16th century Matthew that I was thinking of now. When we returned to the present, that other Matthew would still be here in the past.
If you offer me your blood, neither Matthew nor Jack nor your unborn child has anything to fear from me or mine.
Hubbard imparted the information dispassionately, but his glance was touched with the avarice I'd seen in Rudolph's eyes.
And how much blood would you need? Think. Stay alive.
Very little. No more than a drop.
Hubbard's attention was unwavering.
I couldn't let you take it directly from my body. Matthew would know. We are mates, after all, I said.
Hubbard's eyes flickered to my breast.
I always take my tribute directly from my children's neck.
I'm sure you do, Father Hubbard, but you can understand why that isn't possible or even desirable in this case.
I fell silent, hoping that Hubbard's hunger for power, for knowledge of Matthew and me, for something to hold over the de Clermonts if he ever needed it, would win.
I could use a cup.
No, Hubbard said with a shake of his head. Your blood would be tainted. It must be pure.
A silver cup, then, I said, thinking of chef's lectures at Septour.
You will open the vein in your wrist over my mouth and let the blood fall into it. We will not touch.
Hubbard scowled at me.
Otherwise, I will doubt the sincerity of your offer.
Very well, Father Hubbard. I accept your terms. I loosened the tie at my right cuff and pushed up the sleeve. While I did so, I whispered a silent request to Cora.
Where do you wish to do this? From what I saw before, your children kneel before you, but that will not work if I'm to drip the blood into your mouth.
It is a sacrament. It does not matter to God who kneels.
To my surprise, Hubbard dropped to the floor before me. He handed me a knife.
I don't need that. I flicked my finger at the blue traceries on my wrist and murmured a simple unbinding charm. A line of crimson appeared. The blood welled.
Hubbard opened his mouth, his eyes on my face.
He was waiting for me to renege or cheat him somehow, but I would obey the letter of this agreement, though not its spirit.
Thank you, Goody Alsop, I said, sending her a silent blessing for showing me how to handle the man. I held my wrist over his mouth and clenched my fist. A drop of blood rolled over the edge of my arm and began to fall. Hubbard's eyes flickered closed, as if he wanted to concentrate on what my blood would tell him.
What is blood if not fire and water? I murmured.
I called on the wind to slow the droplets' fall. As the power of the air increased, it froze the falling bead of blood so that it was crystalline and sharp when it landed on Hubbard's tongue. The vampire's eyes shot open in confusion. No more than a drop. The wind had dried the remaining blood against my skin in a maze of red streaks over the blue veins. You are a man of God, a man of your word, are you not, Father Hubbard?
Cora's tail loosened from around my waist. She'd used it to block our baby from having any knowledge of this sordid transaction. But now she seemed to want to use it to beat Hubbard senseless. Slowly, I withdrew my arm. Hubbard thought about grabbing it back to his mouth. I saw the idea cross his mind as clearly as I had seen Edward Kelly contemplate clubbing me with his walking stick. But he thought better of it. I whispered another simple spell to close the wound and turned wordlessly to leave.
When you are next in London, Hubbard said softly, God will whisper it to me. And if he wills it, we shall meet again. But remember this. No matter where you go, from now even unto death, some small piece of you will live within me.
I stopped and looked back at him. His words were menacing, but the expression on his face was thoughtful, even sad. My pace quickened as I left the church crypt, wanting to put as much distance as I could between me and Andrew Hubbard.
Farewell, Diana Bishop, he called after me.
I was halfway across town before I realized that no matter how little that single drop of blood might have revealed, Father Hubbard now knew my real name. Walter and Matthew were shouting at each other when I returned to the Heart and Crown.
Raleigh's groom could hear them, too. He was in the courtyard, holding the reins of Walter's black beast of a horse and listening to their argument through the open windows.
"It will mean my death, and hers, too. No one must know she is with child."
Oddly enough, it was Walter speaking. "You cannot abandon the woman you love and your own child in an attempt to stay true to the Queen, Walter. Elizabeth will find out that you have betrayed her, and Bess will be ruined forever."
"What do you expect me to do, marry her? If I do so without the Queen's permission, I'll be arrested."
"You'll survive no matter what happens," Matthew said flatly. "If you leave Bess without your protection, she will not."
"How can you pretend concern for marital honesty after all the lies you've told about Diana? Some days you insisted you were married, but made us swear to deny it should any strange witches or worse come sniffing around asking questions."
Walter's voice dropped, but the ferocity remained.
"Do you expect me to believe you're going to return whence you came and acknowledge her as your wife?"
I slipped into the room unnoticed. Matthew hesitated.
"I thought not," Walter said.
He was pulling on his gloves.
"Is this how you two want to say your farewells?" I asked.
"Diana," Walter said warily.
"Hello, Walter. Your groom is downstairs with the horse."
He started toward the door, but stopped.
"Be sensible, Matthew. I cannot lose all credit at court. Bess understands the dangers of the Queen's anger better than anyone. At the court of Elizabeth, fortune is fleeting, but disgrace endures forever."
Matthew watched his friend thud down the stairs.
"God forgive me. The first time I heard this plan, I told him it was wise. Poor Bess."
"What will happen to her when we're gone?" I asked.
"Come autumn, Bess's pregnancy will begin to show. They will marry in secret. When the Queen questions their relationship, Walter will deny it, repeatedly. Bess's reputation will be ruined, her husband will be found out to be a liar, and they will both be arrested."
"And the child?" I whispered.
"Will be born in March and dead the following autumn."
Matthew sat down at the table, his head in his hands. "I will write to my father and make sure that Bess receives his protection. Perhaps Susanna Norman will see to her during the pregnancy."
"Neither your father nor Susanna can shield her from the blow of Raleigh's denial." I rested my hands on his sleeve.
"And will you deny that we are married when we return?"
"It's not that simple," Matthew said, looking at me with haunted eyes.
"That's what Walter said. You told him he was wrong." I remembered Goody Alsop's prophecy. "Old worlds die and new be born. The time is coming when you'll have to choose between the safety of the past and the promise of the future, Matthew."
"And the past cannot be cured, no matter how hard I try," he said. "It's something I'm always telling the Queen when she agonizes over a bad decision.
Hoist by my own petard again, as Galloglass would be quick to point out."
"You beat me to it, Uncle."
Galloglass had soundlessly entered the room and was unloading parcels.
"I've got your paper and your pens, and some tonic for Jack's throat." "That's what he gets for spending all his time up towers with Tom, talking about the stars."
Matthew rubbed his face.
"We will have to make sure Tom is provided for, Galloglass. Walter won't be able to keep him in service much longer. Henry Percy will need to step into the breach again, but I should contribute something to his upkeep, too." "Speaking of Tom, have you seen his plans for a one-eyed spectacle to view the heavens? He and Jack are calling it a star glass."
My scalp tingled as the threads of the room snapped with energy. Time sounded a low protest in the corners. "A star glass?" I kept my voice even. "What does it look like?"
"Ask him yourself," Galloglass said, turning his head toward the stairs.
Jack and Mop careened into the room. Tom followed absently behind, a pair of broken spectacles in his hand.
"You will certainly leave a mark on the future if you meddle with this, Diana," Matthew warned.
"Look, look, look!"
Jack brandished a thick piece of wood. Mop followed its movements and snapped his jaws at the stick as it went by.
"Master Harriet said if we hollowed this out and put a spectacle lens in the end, it would make faraway things seem near. Do you know how to carve, Master Royden? If not, do you think the joiner in St. Dunstan's might teach me? Are there any more buns? Master Harriet's stomach has been growling all afternoon."
Let me see that, I said, holding out my hand for the wooden tube. The buns are in the cupboard on the landing, Jack, where they always are. Give one to Master Harriet and take one for yourself. And no, I said, cutting the child off when he opened his mouth. Mop doesn't get to share yours.
Good day, Mistress Royden, Tom said dreamily. If such a simple pair of spectacles can make a man see God's words in the Bible, surely they could be made more complex to help him see God's works in the book of nature. Thank you, Jack.
Tom absently bit into the bun. And how would you make them more complex? I wondered aloud, hardly daring to breathe.
I would combine convex and concave lenses, as the Neapolitan gentleman Signor della Porta suggested in a book I read last year. My arm cannot hold them apart at the proper distance, so we are trying to extend our arm's reach with that piece of wood.
With those words, Thomas Harriot changed the history of science. And I didn't have to meddle with the past. I only had to see to it that the past was not forgotten. But these are just idle imaginings. I will put these ideas down on paper and think about them later, Tom sighed. This was the problem with early modern scientists. They didn't understand the necessity of publishing. In the case of Thomas Harriot, his ideas had definitely perished for want of a publisher.
I think you're right, Tom, but this wooden tube is not long enough.
I smiled at him brightly. As for the joiner in St. Dunstan's, Monsieur Vallon might be of more help if a long, hollow tube is what you need. Shall we go and see him?
Yes, Jack shouted, jumping into the air. Monsieur Vallon has all sorts of gears and springs, Master Harriet. He gave me one and it's in my treasure box. Mine is not as big as Mistress Royden's, but it holds enough. Can we go now?
What is Auntie up to? Gallo Glass asked Matthew, both mystified and wary. I think she's getting back at Walter for not paying sufficient attention to the future, Matthew said mildly.
Oh, that's all right then. And here I thought I smelled trouble.
There's always trouble, Matthew said. Are you sure you know what you're doing, Marlione?
So much had happened that I couldn't fix. I couldn't bring my first child back or save the witches in Scotland. We'd brought Ashmole 782 all the way from Prague, only to discover that it couldn't be taken safely into the future. We had said goodbye to our fathers and were about to leave our friends. Most of these experiences would vanish without a trace, but I knew exactly how to ensure that Tom's telescope survived. I nodded. The past has changed us, Matthew. Why should we not change it, too? Matthew caught my hand in his and kissed it.
Go to Monsieur Vallon, then. Have him send me the bill.
Thank you.
I bent and whispered in his ear, Don't worry, I'll take Annie with me. She'll wear him down on the price. Besides, who knows what to charge for a telescope in 1591?
And so a witch, a demon, two children, and a dog paid a short visit to Monsieur Vallon that afternoon. That evening I sent out invitations to our friends to join us the next night. It would be the last time we saw them. While I dealt with telescopes and supper plans, Matthew delivered Roger Bacon's Virum Secretum Secretorum to Mortlake. I didn't want to see Ashmole 782 pass to Dr. D. I knew it had to go back into the alchemist's enormous library so that Elias Ashmole could acquire it in the 17th century. But it wasn't easy to give the book into someone else's keeping, any more than it had been to surrender the small figurine of the goddess Diana to Kit when we arrived. The practical details surrounding our departure were left to Gallo Glass and Pierre. They packed trunks, emptied coffers, redistributed funds, and sent personal belongings to the old lodge with a practice deficiency that showed how many times they had done this before. Our departure was only hours away. I was returning from Monsieur Vallon's with an awkward package wrapped in soft leather when I was brought up short by the sight of a 10-year-old girl standing on the street outside the pie shop, staring with fascination at the wares in the window. She reminded me of myself at that age. From the unruly straw-blonde hair to the arms that were too long for the rest of her frame. The girl stiffened as if she knew she was being watched. When our eyes met, I knew why. She was a witch.
Rebecca!
A woman called as she came from inside the shop. My heart leaped at the sight, for she looked like a combination of my mother and Sarah.
Rebecca said nothing but continued to stare at me as though she had seen a ghost. Her mother looked to see what had captured the girl's attention and gasped. Her glance tingled over my skin as she took in my face and form. She was a witch too. I forced my feet toward the pie shop. Every step took me closer to the two witches. The mother gathered the child to her skirts, and Rebecca squirmed in protest.
"She looks like Grand Dame,"
Rebecca whispered, trying to get a closer look at me. "Hush," her mother told her. She looked at me apologetically.
"You know that your Grand Dame is dead, Rebecca."
"I am Diana Royden." I nodded to the sign over their shoulders. "I live here at the Heart and Crown."
"But then you are..."
The woman's eyes widened as she drew Rebecca closer.
"I am Rebecca White,"
the girl said, unconcerned with her mother's reaction. She bobbed a shallow, teetering curtsy. That looked familiar, too.
"It is a pleasure to meet you. Are you new to the Blackfriars?"
I wanted to make small talk for as long as possible, if only to stare at their familiar yet strange faces.
"No. We live by the hospital near Smithfield Market," Rebecca explained. "I take in patients when their wards are full."
The woman hesitated.
"I am Bridget White, and Rebecca is my daughter."
Even without the familiar names of Rebecca and Bridget, I recognized these two creatures in the marrow of my bones. Bridget Bishop had been born around 1632, and the first name in the Bishop Grimoire was Bridget's grandmother, Rebecca Davies. Would this 10-year-old girl one day marry and bear that name? Rebecca's attention was caught by something at my neck. I reached up. Isabeau's earrings. I had used three objects to bring Matthew and me to the past. A manuscript copy of Dr. Faustus, a silver chess piece, and an earring hidden in Bridget Bishop's poppet. This earring. I reached up and took the fine golden wire out of my ear. Knowing from my experience with Jack that it was wise to make direct eye contact with children if you wanted to leave a lasting impression, I crouched down until we were at an equal level. "I need someone to keep this safe for me." I held out the earring. "One day I will have need of it. Will you keep it close?" Rebecca looked at me solemnly and nodded. I took her hand, feeling a current of awareness pass between us, and put the jeweled wires into her palm. She wrapped her fingers tightly around them.
"Can I, Mama?"
she whispered belatedly to Bridget.
"I think that would be all right,"
her mother replied warily.
"Come, Rebecca, we must go."
"Thank you," I said, rising and patting Rebecca on the shoulder while looking Bridget in the eye.
"Thank you."
I felt a nudging glance. I waited until Rebecca and Bridget were out of sight before I turned to face Christopher Marlowe.
"Mistress Royden."
Kit's voice was hoarse and he looked like death.
"Walter told me you were leaving tonight."
"I asked him to tell you." I forced Kit to meet my eyes through an act of sheer will. This was another thing I could fix. I could make sure that Matthew said a proper goodbye to a man who had once been his closest friend. Kit looked down at his feet, hiding his face.
"I should never have come."
"I forgive you, Kit." Marlowe's head swung up in surprise at my words.
"Why?"
he asked, dumbstruck.
"Because you love him.
And because as long as Matthew blames you for what happened to me, a part of him remains with you, forever," I said simply. "Come upstairs and say your farewells." Matthew was waiting for us on the landing, having divined that I was bringing someone home. I kissed him softly on the mouth as I went past on the way to our bedroom. "Your father forgave you," I murmured. "Give Kit the same gift in return." Then I left them to patch up what they could in what little time remained. A few hours later, I handed Thomas Harriet a steel tube. "Here is your star glass, Tom."
"I fashioned it from a gun barrel, with adjustments, of course," explained Monsieur Vallon, famous maker of mouse traps and clocks.
and it is engraved as Mistress Royden requested.
There, on the side, set in a lovely little silver banner, was the legend, N. Valen may fake it, T. Harriet may enwain it, 1591. N. Valen made me, T. Harriet invented me, 1591.
I smiled warmly at Monsieur Valen. It's perfect.
Can we look at the moon now?
Jack cried, racing for the door.
It already looks bigger than St. Mildred's clock.
And so Thomas Harriot, mathematician and linguist, made scientific history in the courtyard of the Heart and Crown while sitting in a battered wicker garden chair pulled down from our attics. He trained the long metal tube fitted with two spectacle lenses at the full moon and sighed with pleasure.
Look, Jack, it is just as Signor Della Porta said.
Tom invited the boy into his lap and positioned one end of the tube at his enthusiastic assistant's eye.
Two lenses, one convex and one concave, are indeed the solution if held at the right distance.
After Jack, we all took a turn.
Well, that is not at all what I expected, George Tapman said, disappointed. Did you not think the moon would be more dramatic? I believe I prefer the poet's mysterious moon to this one, Tom.
Why, it is not perfect at all, Henry Percy complained,
rubbing his eyes and then peering through the tube again.
Of course it isn't perfect. Nothing is, Kit said. You cannot believe everything philosophers tell you, Hal. It is a sure way to ruin. You see how little philosophy has done for Tom.
I glanced at Matthew and grinned. It had been some time since we'd enjoyed the School of Night's verbal riposts.
At least Tom can feed himself, which is more than I can say for any of the playwrights of my acquaintance.
Walter peered through the tube and whistled.
I wish you had come up with this notion before we went to Virginia, Tom. It would have been useful for surveying the shore while we were safely aboard ship. Look through this, Galloglass, and tell me I'm wrong.
You are never wrong, Walter, Galloglass said with a wink at Jack. Mind me well, young Jack. The one who pays your wages is correct in all things.
I'd invited Goody Alsop and Susanna to join us, too, and even they took a peek through Tom's star glass. Neither woman seemed overly impressed with the invention, although they both made enthusiastic noises when prompted.
Why do men bother with these trifles? Susanna whispered to me. I could have told them the moon is not perfectly smooth, even without this new instrument. Do they not have eyes?
After the pleasure of viewing the heavens, only the painful farewells remained. We sent Annie off with Goody Alsop, using the excuse that Susanna needed another set of hands to help the old woman across town. My goodbye was brisk, and Annie looked at me uncertainly.
Are you all right, mistress? Shall I stay here instead?
No, Annie. Go with your aunt and Goody Alsop. I blinked back the tears. How did Matthew bear these repeated farewells? Kit, George, and Walter left next, with gruff goodbyes and hands clamped on Matthew's arm to wish him well.
Come, Jack. You and Tom will go home with me, Henry Percy said. The night is still young.
I don't want to go, Jack said.
He swung around to Matthew, eyes huge. The boy sensed the impending change. Matthew knelt before him.
There is nothing to be afraid of, Jack. You know Master Harriet and Lord Northumberland. They won't let you come to harm.
What if I have a nightmare? Jack whispered.
Nightmares are like Master Harriet's star glass. They are a trick of the light, one that makes something distant seem closer and larger than it really is.
Oh. Jack considered Matthew's response. So even if I see a monster in my dreams, it cannot reach me?
Matthew nodded.
But I will tell you a secret. A dream is a nightmare in reverse. If you dream of someone you love, that person will seem closer, even if far away.
He stood and put his hand on Jack's head for a moment in a silent blessing. Once Jack and his guardians had departed, only Galloglass remained. I took the cords from my spell box, leaving a few items within, a pebble, a white feather, a bit of the rowan tree, my jewelry, and the note my father had left.
I'll take care of it, he promised, taking the box from me.
It looked oddly small in his huge hand.
He wrapped me up in a bear hug.
"Keep the other Matthew safe, so he can find me one day," I whispered in his ear, my eyes scrunched tight. I released him and stepped aside. The two de Clermonts said their goodbyes as all de Clermonts did, briefly but with feeling. Pierre was waiting with the horses outside the cardinal's hat. Matthew handed me up into the saddle and climbed into his own.
"Farewell, madame," Pierre said, letting go of the reins.
"Thank you, friend," I said, my eyes filling once more. Pierre handed Matthew a letter. I recognized Philippe's seal.
"Your father's instructions, milord."
"If I don't turn up in Edinburgh in 2 days, come looking for me."
"I will,"
Pierre promised, as Matthew clucked to his horse and we turned toward Oxford. We changed horses 3 times and were at the old lodge before sunrise. Francoise and Charles had been sent away. We were alone. Matthew left the letter from Philippe propped up on his desk, where the 16th century Matthew couldn't fail to see it. It would send him to Scotland on urgent business. Once there, Matthew Royden would stay at the court of King James for a time before disappearing to start a new life in Amsterdam.
"The King of Scots will be pleased to have me back to my former self," Matthew commented, touching the letter with his fingertip.
"I won't be making any more attempts to save witches, certainly."
"You made a difference here, Matthew," I said, sliding my arm around his waist. "Now we need to sort things out in our present." We stepped into the bedroom where we'd arrived all those months before. "You know, I can't be sure that we'll slip through the centuries and land in exactly the right time and place," I warned.
"You've explained it to me, mon coeur. I have faith in you."
Matthew hooked his arm through mine to anchor me.
"Let's go meet our future. Again."
"Goodbye, house." I looked around our first home one last time. Even though I would see it again, it wouldn't be the same as it was on this June morning. The blue and amber threads in the corners snapped and keened impatiently, filling the room with light and sound. I took a deep breath and knotted my brown cord, leaving the end hanging free. Apart from Matthew and the clothes on our backs, my weaver's cords were the only objects we were taking back with us. "With knot of one, the spell's begun," I whispered. Time's volume increased with every knot I made, until the shrieking and keening was nearly deafening. As the ends of the ninth cord fused together, we picked up our feet, and our surroundings slowly dissolved.
Chapter 40. All the English papers had some variation of the same headline, but Isabeau thought the one in the Times was the cleverest. "English man wins race to see into space." June 30th, 2010. "The world's leading expert on early scientific instruments at Oxford University's Museum of the History of Science, Anthony Carter, confirmed today that a refracting telescope bearing the names of Elizabethan mathematician and astronomer Thomas Harriot and Nicholas Valin, a Huguenot clockmaker who fled France for religious reasons, is indeed genuine. In addition to the names, the telescope is engraved with the date 1591. The discovery has electrified the scientific and historical communities. For centuries, Italian mathematician Galileo Galilei had been credited with borrowing rudimentary telescope technology from the Dutch in order to view the moon in 1609.
"The history books will have to be rewritten," said Carter. "Thomas Harriot had read Giambattista della Porta's Natural Magic and become intrigued with how convex and concave lenses could be used to see both things afar off and things near hand, both greater and clearly."
Thomas Harriot's contributions to the field of astronomy were overlooked, in part because he didn't publish them, preferring to share his discoveries with a close group of friends some call the School of Night. Under the patronage of Walter Raleigh and Henry Percy, the Wizard Earl of Northumberland, Harriot was financially free to explore his interests. Mr. I. P. Riddle discovered the telescope,
along with a box of assorted mathematical papers in Thomas Harriot's hand and an elaborate silver mousetrap also signed by Valen. He was repairing the bells of St. Michael's Church near the Percy family seat in Alnwick when a particularly strong gust of wind brought down a faded tapestry of St. Margaret slaying the dragon, revealing the box that had been secreted there.
"It is rare for instruments of this period to have so many identifying marks," Dr. Carter explained to reporters,
revealing the date mark stamped into the telescope, which confirms the item was made in 1591-92.
"We owe a great debt to Nicholas Valen, who knew that this was an important development in the history of scientific instrumentation and took unusual measures to record its genealogy and provenance."
"They refused to sell it," Marcus said, leaning against the doorframe. With his arms and legs crossed, he looked very much like Matthew.
"I've spoken with everyone, from the Alnwick church officials to the Duke of Northumberland to the Bishop of Newcastle. They're not going to give up the telescope, not even for the small fortune you've offered. I think I've convinced them to let me buy the mousetrap, though."
"The old world knows about it," Isabeau said. "Even Le Monde has reported the story."
"We should have tried harder to squash the story.
This could give the witches and their allies vital information," Marcus said. The growing number of people living inside the walls of Set Tour had been worrying for weeks about what the congregation might do if the exact whereabouts of Diana and Matthew were discovered.
"What does Phoebe think?" Isabeau asked.
She had taken an instant liking to the observant young human with her firm chin and gentle ways. Marcus's face softened. It made him look as he had before Matthew left, when he was carefree and joyful. "She thinks it's too soon to tell what damage has been done by the telescope's discovery."
"Smart girl," Isabeau said with a smile.
"I don't know what I'd do," Marcus began.
His expression turned fierce.
"I love her, grandmère."
"Of course you do. And she loves you, too."
After the events of May, Marcus had wanted her with the rest of the family and had brought her to Set Tour to stay. The two of them were inseparable. And Phoebe had shown remarkable savoir-faire as she met the assembly of demons, witches, and vampires currently in residence. If she had been surprised to learn there were other creatures sharing the world with humans, she hadn't revealed it. Membership in Marcus's conventicle had swelled considerably over the past months. Matthew's assistant Miriam was now a permanent resident at the chateau, as were Philippe's daughter Varin and her husband Ernst. Galloglass, Isabeau's restless grandson, had shocked them all by staying put there for 6 whole weeks. Even now he showed no signs of leaving. Sophie Norman and Nathaniel Wilson welcomed their new baby, Margaret, into the world under Isabeau's roof, and now the baby's authority in the chateau was second only to the de Clermont matriarchs. With her grandchild living at Set Tour, Nathaniel's mother Agatha appeared and reappeared without warning, as did Matthew's best friend Hamish. Even Baldwin flitted through occasionally. Never in her long life had Isabeau expected to be the chatelaine of such a household.
"Where is Sarah?" Marcus asked,
tuning in to the hum of activity all around.
"I don't hear her."
"In the round tower."
Isabeau ran her sharp nail around the edge of the newspaper story and neatly lifted the clipped columns from their printed surround.
"Sophie and Margaret sat with her for a while. Sophie says Sarah is keeping watch."
"For what? What's happened now?" Marcus said, snatching at the newspaper.
He'd read them all that morning, tracking the subtle shifts in money and influence that Nathaniel had found a way to analyze and isolate so that they could be better prepared for the congregation's next move. A world without Phoebe was inconceivable, but Nathaniel had become nearly as indispensable.
"That damn telescope is going to be a problem, I just know it. All the congregation needs is a time-walking witch in this story, and they'll have everything they need to go back into the past and find my father."
"Your father won't be there for much longer, if he's still there at all."
"Really, grandmère," Marcus said with a note of exasperation, his attention still glued to the text surrounding the hole that Isabeau had left in the Times. "How can you possibly know that?"
"First, there were the miniatures, then the laboratory records, and now this telescope.
I know my daughter-in-law.
This telescope is exactly the kind of gesture Diana would make if she had nothing left to lose.
Isabeau brushed past her grandson. Diana and Matthew are coming home.
Marcus's expression was unreadable.
I expected you to be happier about your father's return, Isabeau said quietly, stopping by the door.
It's been a difficult few months, Marcus said somberly. The congregation made it clear they want the book and Nathaniel's daughter. Once Diana is here,
they will stop at nothing.
Isabeau took in a slow breath.
At least we will no longer have to worry about something happening to Diana and Matthew in the past. We will be together, except to fighting side by side.
Dying side by side. So much has changed since last November.
Marcus stared into the shining surface of the table as though he were a witch and it might show him the future.
In their lives too, I suspect.
But your father's love for you is a constant. Sarah needs Diana now. You need Matthew, too.
Isabeau took her clipping and headed for the round tower, leaving Marcus to his thoughts. Once it had been Philippe's favorite jail. Now it was used to store old family papers. Though the door to the room on the third floor was ajar, Isabeau rapped on it smartly.
You don't have to knock. This is your house.
The rasp in Sarah's voice indicated how many cigarettes she'd been smoking and how much whiskey she'd been drinking.
If that's how you behave, I'm glad not to be your guest, Isabeau said sharply.
My guest?
Sarah laughed softly. I would never have let you into my house.
Vampires don't usually require an invitation.
Isabeau and Sarah had perfected the art of acerbic banter. Marcus and M had tried without success to persuade them to obey the rules of courteous communication, but the two clan matriarchs knew that their sharp exchanges helped maintain their fragile balance of power.
You should not be up here, Sarah.
Why not?
Afraid I'll catch my death of cold?
Sarah's voice hitched with sudden pain, and she doubled over as if she'd been struck.
Goddess help me, I miss her. Tell me this is a dream, Isabeau. Tell me that Emily is still alive.
It's not a dream, Isabeau said as gently as she could. We all miss her. I know that you are empty and aching inside, Sarah.
And it will pass, Sarah said dully.
No, it won't.
Sarah looked up, surprised at Isabeau's vehemence.
Every day of my life I yearn for Philippe. The sun rises and my heart cries out for him. I listen for his voice, but there is silence. I crave his touch.
When the sun sets, I retire in the knowledge that my mate is gone from this world, and I will never see his face again.
If you're trying to make me feel better, it's not working, Sarah said, the tears streaming.
Emily died so that Sophie and Nathaniel's child might live. Those who played a part in killing her will pay for it, I promise you. The de Clermonts are very good at revenge, Sarah.
And revenge will make me feel better?
Sarah squinted up through her tears.
No. Seeing Margaret grow to womanhood will help. So will this.
Isabeau dropped the cutting into the witch's lap.
Diana and Matthew are coming home.
Part 6. New World, Old World. Chapter 41. My attempts to reach the old lodge's future from its past were unsuccessful. I focused on the look and smell of the place and saw the threads that bound Matthew and me to the house. Brown and green and gold, but they slipped out of my fingers repeatedly. I tried for Set Tour instead. The threads that linked us there were tinged with Matthew's idiosyncratic blend of red and black shot through with silver. I imagined the house full of familiar faces, Sarah and Em, Isabeau and Mart, Marcus and Miriam, Sophie and Nathaniel.
but I couldn't reach that safe port either.
Resolutely ignoring the rising panic, I searched among hundreds of options for an alternative destination. Oxford? The Blackfriars Underground Station in modern London? St. Paul's Cathedral? My fingers kept returning to the same strand in the warp and weft of time that was not silky and smooth, but hard and rough. I inched along its twisting length and discovered that it was not a thread, but a root connected to some unseen tree. With that realization, I tripped, as over an invisible threshold, and fell into the keeping room of the Bishop House. Home. I landed on my hands and knees, the knotted cords flattened between my palms and the floor. Centuries of polish and the passage of hundreds of ancestral feet had long since smoothed out its wide pine boards. They felt familiar under my hands, a token of permanence in a world of change. I looked up, half expecting to see my aunts waiting in the front hall. It had been so easy to find my way back to Madison that I assumed they were guiding us. But the air in the Bishop House was still and lifeless, as though not a soul had disturbed it since Halloween. Not even the ghosts seemed to be in residence. Matthew was kneeling next to me, his arm still linked to mine and his muscles trembling from the stress of moving through time. "Are we alone?" I asked. He took in the house's scents. "Yes." With his quiet response, the house wakened and the atmosphere went from flat and lifeless to thick and uneasy in a blink. Matthew looked at me and smiled. "Your hair. It's changed again." I glanced down to find not the strawberry blonde curls I'd grown accustomed to, but straight, silky strands that were a brighter reddish gold, just like my mother's hair. It must be the time walking. The house creaked and moaned. I felt it gathering its energy for an outburst. "It's only me and Matthew." My words were soothing, but my voice was oddly accented and harsh. The house recognized it nonetheless, and a sigh of relief filled the room. A breeze came down the chimney, carrying an unfamiliar aroma of chamomile mixed with cinnamon. I looked over my shoulder to the fireplace and the cracked wooden panels that surrounded it and scrambled to my feet. "What the hell is that?" A tree had erupted from under the grate. Its black trunk filled the chimney, and its limbs had pushed through the stone in the surrounding wood paneling. "It's like the tree from Mary's alembic." Matthew crouched down by the hearth in his black velvet breeches and embroidered linen shirt. His finger touched a small lump of silver embedded in the bark. Like mine, his voice sounded out of time and place. "That looks like your pilgrim's badge." The outline of Lazarus's coffin was barely recognizable. I joined him, my full black skirts belling out over the floor.
"I think it is."
The ampulla had two gilded hollows inside to hold holy water. Before I left Oxford, I'd filled one with my blood and the other with yours. Matthew's eyes met mine. Having our blood so close made me feel as though we could never be separated. "It looks as though the ampulla was exposed to heat and partially melted. If the inside of the ampulla was gilded, traces of mercury would have been released along with the blood."
"So this tree was made with some of the same ingredients as Mary's Arbor Diani."
Matthew looked up into the bare branches. The scent of chamomile and cinnamon intensified. The tree began to bloom, but not the usual fruit or flowers. Instead, a key and a single sheet of vellum sprouted from the branches.
"It's the page from the manuscript," said Matthew, pulling it free.
"That means the book is still broken and incomplete in the 21st century. Nothing we did in the past altered that fact."
I took a steadying breath. "Then the likelihood is that Ashmole 782 is safely hidden in the Bodleian Library," Matthew said quietly. "This is the key to a car."
He snagged it off the branches. For months, I hadn't thought about any form of transportation besides a horse or a ship. I looked out the front window, but no vehicle awaited us there. Matthew's eyes followed mine.
"Marcus and Hamish would have made sure we had a way to get to Set Tor as planned without calling them for help. They probably have cars waiting all over Europe and America just in case. But they wouldn't have left one visible," Matthew continued.
"There's no garage."
"The hop barn."
Matthew's hand automatically moved to slide the key into the pocket at his hip,
but his clothing had no such modern conveniences.
Would they have thought to leave clothes for us too?
I gestured down at my embroidered jacket and full skirts. They were still dusty from the unpaved 16th century Oxford Road.
Let's find out.
Matthew carried the key and the page from Ashmole 782 into the family room and kitchen. Still brown, I commented, looking at the checked wallpaper and ancient refrigerator.
Still home, Matthew said, drawing me into the crook of his arm.
Not without Em and Sarah. In contrast with the overstuffed household that had surrounded us for so many months, our modern family seemed fragile and its membership small. Here there was no Mary Sidney to discuss my troubles with in the course of a stormy evening. Neither Susanna nor Goody Alsop would drop by the house in the afternoon for a cup of wine and to help me perfect my latest spell. I wouldn't have Annie's cheerful assistance to get me out of my corset and skirts. Mop wasn't underfoot, or Jack. And if we needed help, there was no Henry Percy to rush to our aid without question or hesitation. I slid my hand around Matthew's waist, needing a reminder of his solid indestructibility.
"You will always miss them," he said softly, gauging my mood. "But the pain will fade in time."
"I'm beginning to feel more like a vampire than a witch," I said ruefully. "Too many goodbyes. Too many missing loved ones." I spotted the calendar on the wall. It showed the month of November. I pointed it out to Matthew.
"Is it possible that no one has been here since last year?" he wondered, worried.
"Something must be wrong," I said, reaching for the phone.
"No," said Matthew. "The congregation could be tracing the calls or watching the house. We're expected at Set Tour." "Whether our time away can be measured in an hour or a year, that's where we need to go."
We found our modern clothes on top of the dryer, slipped into a pillowcase to keep them from getting dusty. Matthew's briefcase sat neatly beside them. Em, at least, had been here since we left. No one else would have thought of such practicalities. I wrapped our Elizabethan clothes in the linens, reluctant to let go of these tangible remnants of our former lives, and tucked them under my arms like two lumpy footballs. Matthew slid the page from Ashmole 782 into his leather bag, closing it securely. Matthew scanned the orchard and the fields before we left the house, his keen eyes alert to possible danger. I made my own sweep of the place with my witch's third eye, but no one seemed to be out there. I could see the water under the orchard, hear the owls in the trees, taste the summer sweetness in the dusk air, but that was all.
"Come on," Matthew said, grabbing one of the bundles and taking my hand.
We ran across the open space to the hop barn. Matthew put all his weight against the sliding door and pushed, but it wouldn't budge. Sarah put a spell on it. I could see it, twisted around the handle and through the grain of the wood. A good one, too.
"Too good to break?"
Matthew's mouth was tight with worry. It wasn't surprising that he was concerned. Last time we were here, I hadn't been able to light the Halloween pumpkins. I located the loose ends of the bindings and grinned. "No knots. Sarah's good, but she's not a weaver." I tucked my Elizabethan silks into the waistband of my leggings. When I pulled them free, the green and brown cords in my hand reached out and latched onto Sarah's spell, loosening the restrictions my aunt had placed on the door faster than even our master thief Jack could have managed it. Sarah's Honda was parked inside the barn.
"How the hell are we going to fit you into that?" I wondered.
"I'll manage," Matthew said, tossing our clothes into the back. He handed me the briefcase, folded himself into the front seat, and after a few false starts, the car sputtered to life.
"Where next?" I asked, fastening my seatbelt.
"Syracuse, then Montreal, then Amsterdam, where I have a house." Matthew put the car into drive and quietly rolled it into the field. "If anyone is watching us, they'll be looking in New York, London, and Paris."
"We don't have passports," I observed.
"Look under the mat. Marcus would have told Sarah to leave them there," he said. I peeled up the filthy mats and found Matthew's French passport and my American one.
"Why isn't your passport burgundy?" I asked, taking them out of the sealed plastic bag, another M touch, I thought.
because it's a diplomatic passport. He steered out onto the road and switched on the headlights. There should be one for you. My French diplomatic passport